Howdy.
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 When the annals of contemporary South African music are discussed and debated by future generations, there will be a special place for those pioneers and mavericks who blaze new roads in culture. Renegades that railed against established industry and made music that challenged the status quo and remained true to their independent spirit. My guests in this episode are Shifty Records founder Lloyd Ross and Warwick Stoney, creator of the hugely influential Kalahari Surfers. How's it?
Hugely, pretty good, Benji.
Hugely influential.
Yeah, absolutely. Like absolutely. Lloyd, where do you hail from?
I actually hail from Escape Town, where I've actually returned to, even though when I left it, when I was probably about 20 to go and seek my fortune in, as you say, the big smoke of Johannesburg, I kind of swore I'd never come back. But then again, I'm not really back because I live in Komaki now, which is not really Cape Town. It's 45 kilometers away, and I rarely go there. So, actually, Warwick is my neighbor, so he didn't do much commuting.
Oh, you're in Olsen Komaki?
Yeah. Across the road, literally.
You're from PE, right?
Yeah, no, I was there until I was six. So it's kind of culturally, I'm not really affiliated to PE, more to Durban, where I moved after the age of six. So all my schooling was in Durban. So I see myself as more of a Durban person than a Gqeberha person.
Yeah, we're all transplants of some sort, aren't we? For both of you, were you always going to be in music? Was that always your kind of aim when you were kind of growing up?
Okay, do you remember those days when, you know, before the days of tape and digital, when you just had basically a record and you wanted to learn the song, right? So to learn the song, you had to keep on putting the needle back and back and back until you got the notes right, et cetera, et cetera. So I did a lot of that, and probably when I was 13, 14, when I started getting interested in music. And from then, I just continued.
What were you listening to at that particular point?
I've got a kind of a brain where a little drawer slide out, and I can remember all those like pop songs from the radio from the 60s and 70s, and I can remember the odd lyrics. In fact, you know, the choruses I can often remember, you know. And that's, I find that quite incredible because otherwise my memory is terrible. But in terms of, I suppose the chief influence in my life was a guy coming to school that had an underground record collection. He called it an underground record collection. And before that, I'd never heard like Deep Purple or any of these bands because on the SABC, you didn't really hear.
No.
Did you Smoke on the Water and that kind of thing? Not really. I can't remember if you did.
No.
Maybe on specialist programs, but this would have been the early 70s, late 60s, I guess, for me, because I was born in 57. So 1970, I was 13 years old, which sort of kind of figures then. So that started, I think that's sort of my real interest in music and interest in music that wasn't just pop music, even though I still, I really love a good tune, I love a good pop song. Warwick has got a very different trajectory, I think.
Yeah, what were you listening to, Warwick?
Well, I didn't really like the radio much, but I did like the Beatles, the White Album particularly, and the Indian stuff. I grew up in Durban, so I was quite into Indian music. I had lessons at the Surat School. I played tabla. I loved the whole Indian thing because of George Harrison mainly. Mm. And so that and prog rock, kind of the quite difficult sort of rock and sort of synthesis of those in a weird way. And then the one chord wonder. So I went from prog to the other side of things of, the apex of songwriting, I think, is the guy can write a song with one chord and it's got a verse, a chorus, and a middle eight amongst it all.
I think, example, please.
Well, the Soul Brothers. actually a lot of music. Bo Diddley,
Bo Diddley's pretty much one chord, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, Bo Diddley. And the main lyric was his name. So for me,
you wasn't going to forget the lyrics.
yeah, you don't want to forget. So for me, that's the apex of music, to be able to write a song with your name as the main lyric, one chord, and you manage to get... I mean, it was huge, hugely influential.
Well, I've just learned something, Benji, about Warwick, which I didn't know before.
Bo Diddley, I would never have guessed. Lloyd, I know you spent some time in the UK in the late 70s when that sonic revolution called punk was happening. How did that affect you from a musical point of view?
Well, I mean, I suppose anybody that kind of was, like a teenager or early 20s or whatever, that had a certain idea about music would have been very affected by about Western music. You know, we were being very affected by the punk, the whole punk thing and the new wave thing. And, you know, I was there, I was doing the typical kind of thing, sort of hitching around Europe, spent, I think in the end, about 8 months in England working on, you know, sort of like farms, picking strawberries and apples and all that kind of thing. You meet people and you get influenced by their song, you know, their music choices. You end up going to concerts and you end up getting turned on to new things, which is what we should be doing our whole lives, actually, is, you know, exploring new things and finding new ways of making ourselves happy by listening to things or doing things, anything in art or whatever. So it affected me in quite a big way. So when I came back to South Africa, I had this sort of thing about where was that music in South Africa. And I happened to see, as I was passing through Joburg on my way back to Cape Town, I happened to see the Radio Rats at the market. They were playing at Dave Marks's Market Theatre Cafe, I think it was called. Was it called the Market Cafe?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And I was very affected by that. You know, even though they weren't really punk, they had a definite new wave look to them.
Welcome to my car, to my rolling limousine, to my nicotine scented boudoir, lined in black velvet like a quiet space helmet, each gadget designed to unmake me. Chevy, steam up my windows, please. Excuse all the driving debris. You know the marquee decided would have turned green with envy at the sight of the stains on my upholstery. When I get bored by driving shows, I find the backseat so bizarre. So come on, steam up my windows. Welcome to my car. Welcome to my car. Gasoline scented boudoir. You know, I dated Snow White once. She put up quite a resistance to me and the dwarves in the backseat. Now, welcome to my Chevy. Steam up my windows, please.
Very garagey, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. But they had a very fresh feel, which you weren't used to in South Africa. When I heard a little bit later that they were looking for a guitarist, I think maybe somebody wrote about it in the Sunday Times. I kind of wrote Jonathan later because I had his details and said, you know, I'd like to come and audition. He sent me a message back saying, we're not actually looking for a guitarist. And I said, I'm coming anyway. So I hitched up with my guitar and did an audition and I was in. And that was when my whole sort of relationship with the East Rand scene started. That's where I met James Phillips. We shared a rehearsal room with James and the Corporal Punishment, James and Carl and the boys. And that's probably the beginning of Shifty right there.
With National Wake there, in that set up.
Yeah, I met Ivan later. Yeah, probably about a year.
Warwick, in tandem with punk was also the avant-garde movement, which was spanning early free-form initiates like Mothers of Invention, Caravan, Robert Wyatt, Can, which I know you've been influenced by.
Yeah, Can were the ultimate One Chord Wonder. Can would manage to get a One Chord Wonder and make it last for 20 minutes, the whole side of an album.
I mean, you listened to that first Can album, Monster Movie. I mean, it is. The one side is just one riff throughout, while Malcolm Mooney yelling, you know, his head off. He was a real character. Were those influences for what you were going to do later with Kalahari Surfers.
What was interesting was that coming, all that, and then punk happened. And along with punk came, I played with Guillaume in a band called Rude Dementals.
Guillaume Musso, Gil Gap, as he calls
Gil himself. Gap, he was in the Safari Suits, and then he had Housewife's Choice, and I took over on bass, from Simon Rice.
This is more or less when I met you.
Yeah, that must have been around about
Cape Town
time.
Scene,
But by then, punk had evolved, although we were playing pretty strict punk. We were playing a lot of covers like Vibrators, and then we'd take 60 songs like Lola and stuff and redo them in that, but it was proper punk. And then I met Lloyd, and we were more interested in what has later been categorized as post-punk, which was the art music side of things. So the Happy Ships and the Surfers kind of existed in the post-punk art music sort of realm, really, influenced by all sorts of things. You know, Père Ubu, there were loads and loads of bands that, in fact, punk just lasted for 2 years, I think, 77, 78, and a little bit into 79. Thereafter, it broke down all the rules, and it was a very free period of music. Simon Reynolds has written a great book on that whole late 70s, right up until the close of the 80s, on how free it was. You know, you had...
The hardcore punk came from Durban, though. I mean, obviously had Wild Youth, the Dead Babies, La Metro Trois, bands like that. That's also where I kind of, around about that time is where I heard the Corporals as well, because as you said, they were from Springs, and I was from the neighboring town of Brakpan. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the Brakpan, and there was no love lost between Brakpan and Springs.
Family.
So the two of you got together and you formed Happy Ships. Now, if you don't know the Happy Ships, just explain what they were about musically.
I mean, Happy Ships came out of, I suppose, it was just a melting pot of was it five people?
Yeah, and then Jonathan was a sixth, but he just played the pocket.
Yeah, so it was a performance group. It was Lloyd's initiative, really. He came down to Cape Town once a year and pulled us all together, Lloyd's energy. Very disparate, very difficult people, I think.
Yeah.
We
had Hamish, who was meditating 4 hours a day.
Yeah, it's difficult to get him out of his meditation.
And then Wayne, which is impossible anyway.
And Wayne was impossible. He insisted on, for instance, wanted to hang a swastika behind us just to freak the people out at scratch. Yeah, so we had a big fight to take the swastika. Massive thing. I don't know where he found it. So things like they were really, really difficult band. And then Philip Nangle was into farming and didn't want to play musical instruments.
So he played farming.
He brought his farming equipment.
But they wrote a great song together.
Yeah.
Chicken Bacon Plantation.
Yeah, it was very good.
It was about farming, I suppose.
It was about farming,
So sort of forerunner to live Jimmy Presley, I suppose, in a way, if you're using gardening implements.
But less self-consciously hip. We were tragically unhip, really.
Yeah.
I mean, we were all so disparate. We didn't have any uniting features. Hamish would walk on trying to look like John McLaughlin wearing a white robe. And it kind of didn't work either. But it was the funniest band in that way because of those differences. Photographs of us playing, and we're all looking upwards, Lloyd and I, because we were the only two who was quite serious about structuring things like writing lyrics and trying to have a song that had an ending. And there's a picture of Lloyd and I staying, looking up into the air while we're playing. And the reason for that was that at Scratch, we'd press-ticked all the lyrics to the top.
It was like an I-beam just above the stage.
Yeah, it was like a little stage thing. So we're all reading the lyrics like this. Because we didn't rehearse, you know, it was quite improvisatory. I think that was the main thing about it.
Yeah, everybody played every instrument. I mean, I even played drums, which is
we all swapped instruments.
What was the pocket? What was that?
Oh, you put change in your pocket and you tap it. Jonathan's rhythm was quite good, actually.
Yeah, he could play like...
that's the pocket. Okay, I wondered.
Yeah, he could sort of do a... He'd get like a whole lot of... And he'd flick his fingers and got quite a rhythm. We put a microphone near his pocket. And that was, but he was good looking. He was the best looking of us. So
he was good looking, and he also sang on "You're Not Important."
Which is
a great song.
Yeah, but a non-musician. I think that was coming out of punk. That was the important part. You know, was the arrival of the non-musician, and the non-musician becoming, in you know, certainly in England, a lot of those guys became hugely famous.
In fact, I've read that the
most important punk band was the Desperate Bicycles, because none of them could play anything.
So that makes Sid Vicious sound like a virtuoso. I mean,
Sid still managed to play on one string.
That was a Happy Ships, which obviously didn't last long. You came to Joburg, did you?
So I was in Joburg. So I think the first Happy Ships gig, I was still in Cape Town. Then I went to work in the film industry in Joburg. And I used to come down every December and pull the band together. So for about 3 years we did that, eh?
Yeah,
and it was quite a big event. We played at Scratch only.
At Scratch only,
And then the bass, I think it was after that. I don't know if it was it by the bass time. Or
I can't even remember.
Anyway,
it
doesn't matter.
Market Street.
The thing is that, you know, when we did the first Shifty recording, which was actually Sankamorta, the next one we did was Happy Ships.
That's right.
So that was 84. So it must have been 3 years.
So you took the studio all the way down to Cape Town to do the Happy Ships.
Yeah.
So it was the mobile studio and a caravan. Lloyd brought it down. Mm. And we recorded the Happy Ships and Artfuck or Robin Hawkins' band.
And no, we recorded in his garage.
I want to talk about the studio because I'm fascinated with the setup of how you did the recordings. But that album changes hands now when you can find it at a ridiculous amount, the vinyl.
I mean, which one?
I've seen it go, Happy Ships. I've seen it go for $5,000.
Wow.
Oh, really?
Geez, you can have mine for that.
Because it was that kind of, it has that kind of amateurish cover, really, isn't it? I mean, it was just slapped together.
Every single cover was different. So they were all Hansel screened, and they're different colors. Every single cover. In fact, I've got a whole lot of covers here, Benji. They're all different, I can assure you.
It had lots of inserts.
Yeah, we each had to do an insert for the album.
Yeah.
You'll be happy to know a lot of the Shifty stuff sells on vinyl at ridiculous prices. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. In 82, 83, there was a lot of shit going on. The government, who up until now had some modicum of restraint, took the handcuffs off, and there was genuine revolution in the air. There's a piece that you wrote, Lloyd, in the Shifty bio back in 2006. I just want to read that to you. The political slogans of the time were forward to people's power and so on. But in my subculture, the music subculture, there was also a spirit of fuck apartheid, let's dance, as the magazine Vula put it. Young people were ignoring boundaries, listening to each other's music and playing together. Some even believed it was possible to rock apartheid into oblivion, but no one was recording the music. So Lloyd, in that seething cauldron, you made the decision to establish a studio. What was your motivation for this, and did you have a plan? I mean, was it a grand master plan?
Well, the one thing you should know about me, Benji, I never have a plan. You know, if you ask me what I'm doing next week, I won't be able to tell you. But tomorrow, maybe not either. So I'm not really strategic when it comes to that kind of thing. I'm very much governed by my emotions. And it was just, for me, it was obvious, especially after, you know, the thing... hearing the corporal punishment really affected me a lot, just in terms of something that was incredibly authentic, incredibly South African, and the lyrics were just talking about what it was like to be here from a very specific angle. You'll relate to the lyrics of corporal punishment because you came from East Rand as well. You know, so it's like a middle class kind of white perspective of a teenager and just looking at what was going on around him and thinking, fuck this. I just thought that was so powerful. Stage, I was living in a house with Ivan Cady, who was in a band called National Wake, which was probably the very first mixed kind of punkish band in South Africa. And they obviously had their problems because they were mixed. And we kind of decided that it would be great to actually get a studio together. So we both, he had some live gear, like a mixing desk and some microphones and that kind of thing. And I bought a tape recorder. At that stage, it was an 8-track Atari tape recorder on half inch. And that's when the whole idea of the studio sort of got together. And the idea of the mobile studio just came from, I don't know, I just heard of mobile studios overseas and I thought, what a great idea. Because you didn't have to be sort of restricted to where you're recording something. So consequently, the first couple of albums we did were all mobile recordings. You know, so that would be Happy Ships in Cape Town, Sankamorta in Lesotho.
Lesotho, yeah.
And Live at Jamison's. We moved that to outside the Jamison. So, you know, it was amazing in that regard. Well, my chief motivation was this amazing music that was getting recorded, that wasn't getting recorded. And it didn't matter what kind of music it was. That's why if you look at the Shifty catalog, it is incredibly eclectic. You know, right from sort of avant-garde stuff like Warwick's through to People's Poets, through to the Full Freight to the Yana Scarecrow and Coast Gone Bass through to James Phillips' stuff, rock and roll, the whole gamut of whatever was happening at that stage where, you know, people were singing about what was happening to themselves and in an authentic and original way.
The A&R policy was actually no policy.
But also, you know, Lloyd also was able to, because of the mobile thing, he was able to record cultural things. So a lot of UDF, straightforward political events, and hence which was very popular, it was the Fossato Worker Choirs album, which was result of mobile recordings. The pictures of you with the Tapco desk and everything.
Yeah.
So you must have taken the desk out there. It wasn't the whole caravan.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, so yeah. I just had the PCM, the digital two-track. Digital, yeah. It was an early digital two-track.
So this is the beginning of digital as well,
which I bought from Graham Beggs, actually. Yeah. I think when he was going overseas, he sold that to me.
Yeah.
A desk, some cables, and, you know, we went around. At that stage, it was the Transvaal and Natal recording worker choirs.
Because of that technology, you were able to record on a Betamax tape. For 90 minutes?
Three hours straight.
You could just let it run, which is amazing. You couldn't do that before.
Yeah.
Digital. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was in the caravan. It was that acted like a control room. And where did you put the musicians, the drum kits? And
that would depend. So like, for instance, with the first album we did, which was, a story. Warwick, talking about podcasts, Benji, Mm-hmm. Warwick and I have just done our first Shifty podcast. It's called The Rest is Shifty. Okay, so look out for that, guys. It's becoming out sometime. And the first one was, of course, about our first album, Sunken Water, and recording that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a very sort of unusual situation in that the band was banned from South Africa. They weren't allowed to record in South Africa. The only country in the world, Lesotho is the only country in the world that's completely surrounded by another country. So unless they had money to fly somewhere, they weren't going to be doing any recording. No recording facilities, obviously, in Lesotho at all. And we moved the caravan down there. And just to answer your question, in that specific case, the Radio Lesotho had recently moved. So the soundproof studios were still around. And Frank Leopa managed to organize us to record in those studios. So we just ran a cable from the caravan through a door into one of the rooms, and that's the way we recorded. And that's basically what happened in all of our mobile situations. And even in the place where it was permanently in Randmans Properties, the caravan was in a garage. We had this very long cable there.
Huge multi,
40 or 50 meters.
Big fat multi-cable thing.
Which ran into the house, and then we used various rooms in the house to record.
To record, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and the genuine.
I remember seeing Sunken Water in Lesotho. The singer Black Jesus, I think his name was. He was rad.
He was radical. He'd said things like, "What, Warwick?"
Well, that's why they got banned, because he was saying sort of they must chase the whites into the sea and things like that. Yeah,
and also I remember him being very.
Yeah, their name was Uhuru at that stage, which is also not a great name. If you consider the fact that the Uhuru movement in Kenya
ended in tears. Yeah.
Ended in tears.
Yeah.
Once and glorious of Africa, why do you scatter? You're running, you're dying, you're losing your soul. A mother Africa, why don't you speak the other speak? Be conscious of femininity is a password. Password. Anyama Dandi Asika na Africa. Wanje Mugutawa. Mugutawa Mukufa Mugutaya. Anna Africa ino Wanje Simukuyena Tanani Olimba Moine Molimba Umozi Kepane. Umozi Kepane.
So, Warwick, around this time, you fired up Kalahari Surfers, didn't you?
I'd done stuff in Cape Town in a Porter studio. And then Hamish, you know, Kalahari Surfers was myself and a guy called Hamish Davidson. And then the two of us would basically get stoned and just record jams that we did. And we'd play back, we'd make rhythm tracks and play the cassette back on a Vox AC30 and then play over that. So it was like a primitive drum machine. Mm-hmm. And then we got a drummer, Brian Roth. And the early Surfers was when I got up to Joburg and teamed up with Lloyd, I started recording, you know, much better stuff. But the first release was actually a cassette from Cape Town. Mm. I think it was Obs Productions, and I did it on a Porter studio pretty much on my own with Hamish. But Hamish was difficult because he meditated all the time. So he had a little window of about 4 hours a day where you could actually get him. And then he was usually in a bad mood. So it was... from having meditated,
isn't it? Counterintuitive.
No, I don't know.
But he was paid to meditate later.
Later,
he?
Yeah, that's yeah. That's what he did.
He was meditating for world peace.
I find it hard to put two together: the music of Kalahari Surfers and somebody who meditates.
It's hard to put together the meditation and David Lynch, who actually had been meditating like since the '80s, you know.
Oh, serious? Okay.
Yeah, all his movies, he
big proponent of meditation.
I'm talking about the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's meditation, which is the translate TM, was what the Beatles did, you know.
Right. Same as Hamish, also TM, eh?
It's Hamish, yeah. Also TM. And don't forget, the Beatles out of TM got the White Album. They got most of the music for the White Album, Sgt. Pepper, you know, those great last three, and Let It Be. Quite a lot of those were all written in Rishikesh. So it did actually lift the creative kind of juices, really did. Yeah, it was amazing. David Lynch would say I remember reading recently, he said the great thing about meditating is these ideas float past like fish. You just got to reach out and grab them. Brilliant, brilliant way of putting it. So, yeah.
So the first release was Gross National Product. First release, yeah, that was Gross National Product.
Yeah, done an OBS in Cape Town, yeah, on a Porter Studio, which Carl Robenhaber's got the Porter Studio, the exact same machine I used.
I dug it out last night and listened to it because I've got literally a huge archive of South African stuff. It's similar to kind of Brian Eno, David Byrne, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. That's how I've always seen Kalahari Surfers, kind of coming from that place of using loops and radio broadcasts and riffs and, you know, like My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. Would that be a description of Kalahari Surfers?
Yeah, Bush of Ghosts, Holger Zucke made an album called Movies. So the guy, the bass player for Can, he did this great album using Hollywood bits and pieces of movies. And then prior to that, Stockhausen, I went through a phase of listening to a lot of, you know, classical music. The classical guys had quite nice freedoms. In other words, they wouldn't worry about anything to do with melody and chords and things. You know, often it was just really sounds. And then going back with Zappa's first album, we're only in it for the money. The Freak Out. And then particularly We're Only in It for the Money. I had a lot of tape cut-ups and splicings, you know. And then there was a band called Negative Land that were very influential on me. And they were from San Francisco. And they were four guys who didn't play any musical instruments, but they cut tape. They were very good with a razor blade. And they had four quarter-inch tape machines. And they'd circulate the tape around. And once you got bored with what you're working on, pass it on. So in the description of Mark, I met them actually. He said there was more splicing tape than actual tape.
Thick.
It was like thick with plastic splicing tape by the time they'd finished stuff. So those were the basic. And John Cage, of course, was hilarious.
So you bought into the studio at that particular point, didn't you?
Yeah, I joined up with Lloyd 84. We did this Sankamoto. I went down and helped with the Sankamoto recording and learned.
But you hadn't bought the machine then?
No, I hadn't. And then as time went on, we needed to upgrade to 16 tracks. And so we moved from the 8-track, and I went and worked for Bruderborn Film Company to pay off the 16-track tape recorder.
Yeah, well, I was also working for Bruderborn.
And we financed the Bruderborn.
Yeah, you did Faithster, Lloyd, didn't you? You did Faithster.
He did Faithster, yeah.
It was just before the Shifty started going into production.
Did that give you the bucks to... Because, I mean, that was the most unlikely hit single that came out. And, I mean, they even gave you a sorry for it, but you boycotted it.
I think he was very unimpressed with you. Lance James was my publisher.
Oh, Lance James?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so, Benji's married to Lance James's daughter.
Oh, that's amazing. So,
probably
small world.
Yes, exactly.
But Lloyd's dad was hell of impressed. He had the sorry award on his bar.
He did, yeah. I don't know where that is now.
Yeah, well,
we can step by this, probably.
It's a rare collector's
item. Wouldn't have been good for your cred, Lloyd, if you had got it.
Well, that's the whole thing. I actually obviously felt that the saris were maybe a little bit too, you know, like old South Africa. And I was doing, at that stage, I was never really a very political animal. I've never been a joiner or anything like that. But I've always kind of had a moral sense of what's right and wrong. And for me, it was completely obvious what was happening in this country at that stage was very, very wrong. And especially when
I want to touch on that, because both of you have and had and still have strong political views. So you've just touched on it now. When did you become aware of what was happening here? And did you think that through music you could make a bit of a difference to what was happening?
It's a very interesting question as to when does one become aware when you're actually living in a society which has got all the propaganda going and all that kind of thing, and it's the status quo is the status quo, and you're a kid and you're growing up in that sort of situation. But I think for me, when I think about that question, the answer I would give would be my father always told me to respect my elders. And I would see these black people in the street being totally disrespected. I just didn't understand how to figure that out. You know, it just didn't seem like what was happening there. Why was there a difference? They were all people. And so from then, I think probably from when I was 6 or 7, I had the sense that there was something weird going on in South Africa. In terms of the record company as well, I did feel as though we were on a mission. Yes, absolutely. And you said like rocking apartheid out of existence. In a way, we did in the end, actually. Because we'll come to this later, but I think it was the centenary of the Sunday Times. I did a little documentary. That's what I ended up doing later in life, was making documentaries for the Sunday Times. And we interviewed Pip Buerta. And he's kind of said to me, for him, in a way, the Fulfray tour was the straw that broke the camel's back. The kids of the people in power were getting up and saying, listen, we just don't want any part of this.
Okay, people, get up on your feet. It's time to move to a different beat. We don't like the way they're running our days and nights. Our lives are out of phase. We black, white, separated, right from birth indoctrinated. Years and years developed apart. Brainwashed each in the name of God, SD. Educate ourselves. Let's de-educate ourselves. Let's de-educate ourselves. Let's de-educate ourselves. Gave your legs to march to war. Your leaders warned you in a sporting affair. So put on your boots and cut your hair. Don't talk back or stop to think. When you're in Angola, you can have a drink. Obey, obey, they know the way. From here you go to SWA. Where they don't dance. When facing such hostility, they don't dance. They don't dance. When facing such hostility, they don't dance. They don't dance. When facing such hostility, they don't dance. Don't dance. Don't dance. Don't dance. But the SAD is there to see that we all enjoy democracy. Yes, the SAD is there to see that we all enjoy democracy. The SAD is there to see that we all enjoy democracy. The SAD. It's there to see that we all enjoy democracy. The SAD is there to see that we all enjoy democracy. Don't dance.
I think you've got the record for having more records banned or restricted by the Publications Control Board. I mean, particularly you, Warwick.
We had that, but we also had the other thing, which was the quite interesting argument. And there is a song called Play It Backwards on one of my records, which is some of the recordings from the whole accusation that we were hiding messages backwards. After the Fulfray tour. The funny thing is all the messages in Afrikaans. That we're going backwards. Like Chotas Namlus, if you played carols backwards. And you know, Lloyd and I sat in this panel with these guys, these Christian guys, who actually had a DJ set up that they could play the record backwards and forwards with a lever. And they pointed out in our records, they sort of say, listen here, this is Chotas, and you'd hear carol or someone going, and they'd say, can you hear that? That's Chotas Namlus. So then when we had this big showdown with them, I found a Christian record with a big little fish on the cover and everything, and I found some fantastic backward messages in their records. There was one that went forwards. It said, "The Spirit of the Lord is in this place. Satan is in all of our aims." Backwards, it said, "Satan is in all of our aims." I find outrageous stuff on Christian records.
Well, there you go. Certainly very creative. And then there you go. You can find anything you like.
Yeah, I actually found that album, that very album, on YouTube the other day. So it's still around.
That's a great story. I mean, both of you were writing challenging music, provocative music. Was there harassment? Were you targeted? I did the National Wake album in 81. And I mean, we had problems. Even at Weir, we had problems, I mean, with the police about that record. And I mean, they had the house behind Weir. I used to go there and smoke, most days. But we had problems with them. Did you have problems with them?
I think we're generally too small to have problems in a kind of a violence aspect, really. I got one brick through a window, but I think that's because I was staying in a house with some of the activists. That could have been more that. But I think Warwick's right in that it was really the musicians that had the
musicians,
problems.
Yeah. The musicians had much more than us.
Tear gassing live performances and that kind of thing that happened. Times.
In fact, I wrote a song called Tear Gas, which was a loop. Ian Herman was tuning up his drums and I made a loop. It was in 7/8. I had like a riff, a bass riff and a fuzz guitar, one called Wonder, another one. And we went out to see, I think it was, it might have been End Conscription Campaign concert or something. We all got tear gassed. And I came back and I just coughed and said tear gas into the microphone. And that was the song.
That was a lyric.
Yeah, that was a lyric. But that was directly out of being tear gassed, so my voice was all funny.
But there was no overt harassment.
No, we didn't get graded. The kind of things that strangely enough, because the woman who actually owned had the lease of the property that we were on, she actually got killed by the security forces. She was actually in Lesotho. She was a teacher, and she had a husband who was an ANC kind of a Mkhonto guy, and they all got killed the year after we did the. The Sankamoto.
It was 85, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 85. And she...
It was hectic.
It was hectic,
absolutely hectic. It was really hectic because it was like close to Christmas. I think it was like a week before Christmas.
Week before Christmas, you're right. Yeah.
And I bought the Sunday Times. On the front page was Jackie Quinn lying on a mortuary slab.
Yeah.
And the papers had never printed pictures of dead bodies before. I don't know if you remember. There was never, ever anything like that in the newspaper. And it was so completely and utterly shocking. The SADF had done a raid into Lesotho and they'd taken out these people. And she was mother with babe in arms. They took her out, the husband, and the babe was left on the ground. Phoenix, I think her name was.
So
was really hectic. But it had nothing to do with us. You know,
She was just
connected to an ANC operative in Lesotho.
Long have we all waited. Many times have we seen in the eyes of the neighbors, in the eyes of the laborers, a feeling that leaves none to guess who's been walked for who and when, for less than who's been left out there with dust on his dead feet. Look right at the sunset. Look left and poverty. Look on in amazement. Milk first and mass crazy. Nowhere else in the world can you see so many monsters that creep out so efficiently and leave you wondering what happened to all those sacred things. Well, they got shot down. We'll be right back.
get away. But here in my cradle, all I'm capable. I'm a white boy who looked at his life gathered in his hands, the swords all due to the sweat of some other man, that one who got shot down. Street.
Yeah, you see, in the late 70s, they upped their game. They got a lot of, I think they went to France. There's a guy, Roy Ross Swanepoel, who tortured Winnie. He brought in a whole another wave of ways of handling that I think he learned in France when the French were fighting in Algeria.
Oh, right.
They swapped torturing ideas and stuff with Roy Ross, and he brought, and I think he was pretty proud of his contribution. And certainly with Winnie, there was quite a lot of writing about her and what she had to go through.
How were you distributing the stuff at that point? So I know you were frustrated with the distribution network in South Africa.
Well, the Sunken Water record, we couldn't get really anybody to take it. Couldn't get a radio station to play it. Bop Radio.
Tim Medici?
We went to go and see him. He played it. And then Chris Pryor started playing it. And he wore out, apparently he told us he wore out three versions of that album. He loved it so much.
Yeah.
He will have a couple of old Sunken Water albums for you, Benji, if you're looking for used records.
There's one story that goes back to the Happy Ships, and I think it typifies the attitude of the industry to what you were doing. And that was, explain the Pietman story, the cutting engineer.
Pietman Purkita. He took my 200 rand deposit and told me to get lost. So that was done in England. Who took the Happy Ship? Was that done in England as well? Original cut?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had to get them done in England because he refused. Yeah. That's where censorship started in South Africa, was Pietman in his cutting room. Yeah. Can you actually believe it?
Yeah.
This is like a functionary of a big company.
Yeah, EMI.
And he could actually say, no, I'm not cutting this because it has a swear word on it.
Yeah. Political, pornographic, and anti-religious.
Oh, what he said to you?
That was mine.
Was it?
Pornographic was that Surfer song I've Nailed on Every Beach.
I had a similar problem with the National Wake album. Interpack wouldn't print the sleeve because
they wouldn't print the sleeve,
the inner bag with the lyrics on it because of international news. We had to take it off before they would print. If you look on the original version of National Wake, there's a big white empty space where international news was.
Oh, just so petty.
They killed that record. I mean, they. I remember distinctly the dealers just turned against them and just, you know, we could not get that record in the stores.
Yeah. So you see, Benji, there's your answer to why we were the record company with the most banned records, because other record companies would not, apart from you maybe, would not actually touch a record that wouldn't get played on the radio. That was it. If it wouldn't get played on the radio, it wouldn't get recorded.
Yeah.
And in a way, we did completely the opposite.
Yeah.
We recorded music that would never be played on the radio, which is not, if you're thinking about your economy and your financial situation, it's not a great decision to make.
But Lloyd, you went outside of the whole music industry economy and got funding from the Swedes.
Yeah.
So that actually was the way to do this. Mm.
Even for me, it was a very fine balance putting stuff out. There are records I put out that never got airplay. The first Falling Mirror never got any airplay. Warwick, this interests me. How do the Surfer songs develop? What's the process of the criteria that you use?
The two criteria I used, one was writing songs, you know, with three or four chords on guitar, the way people write songs. The other was improvisation, drum loops. I'd make tape loops with drum tracks. I could lay a beat down, you know, as a drummer. I'd play all the instruments. So I'd lay a groove down on bass because I love bass. And then with the advent of drum machines, I was able to lay down bass grooves and, you know, bass and drum grooves. And then I'd build on top of those with synths and then work out a vocal melody. There was a band called This Heat I loved. They'd often have these quite driving rhythm things and then over the top, very slow melodic lines that would thread the whole thing together with interesting lyrics. So, you know, I spent a long time writing lyrics as well, as long as I spent on the music. But, I could play a lot of instruments. Nothing, it wasn't a virtuoso or anything, but I could certainly get around. And because of tabla, I could play percussion. And then in the army, I played trombone. So I put a bit of brass and, you know, cobbled it together. But that's the nice thing about having access to a studio in those days. Even the 8-track, the days of the 8-track, it was fantastic. And then early technology, drum machines and synths and sequences.
Yeah, and then samplers. You bought the 16.
The 16-track was heaven, yeah.
So Warwick brought into the studio by basically investing in a 16-track.
Fostex, B16, yeah. Mm-hmm. Also an half-inch, yeah.
So what were your roles in the studio? Who played what? Did you just do your own thing, Warwick, on your stuff, and Lloyd, you did
pretty
your
much.
Stuff?
Yeah, I'd work in the downtime. You know, Lloyd busy during the day. I think he had a girlfriend. So then I'd get the nights. I'd work at night.
Yeah, you're a night owl. Basically.
I was the night owl, yeah.
Warwick had girlfriends.
Warwick, the album Bigger Than Jesus, which I think echoes John Lennon's comments, I guess, that caused a furore, that album. But you knew that, right? You knew it was going to do that, surely. You call an album Bigger Than Jesus. Do you regard yourself as a bit of a provocateur or just you're holding up a mirror to society and saying, fuck you, this is what I am?
I suppose it was the whole idea of the Christian national thing, you know, Christian nationalism, which was South Africa. So any little prick, you know, pricking Christian nationalism was for me important. You know, on that album, I had a track where I cut up the Lord's Prayer with that raid into Maseru. And that was quite controversial. And that was one of the ones when I went to the arbitration with, I think it was Belduer and Hall. They
law firm.
The law firm, yeah. Because it was banned, we fought it. And that they took particular exception to that track, the Lord's Prayer being cut up, a la William Burroughs. You know, I literally did Our Father who art in burnt homes blast. You know, I just splashed it up. And it was quite strong in that you could feel the Lord's Prayer shifting through the wreckage, you know. And I think they understood. At one time, I think they listened really closely to that album, all five of them. I was quite impressed. So my staunchest.
Five of who?
The panel. It was five guys.
Oh, the censorship board.
There were Dorminis, the censorship board. And then they had to sit and write a judgment, which was a few pages long. And, you know, they gave it to the lawyers. And the thing was, it could be unbanned. The precedent set by Dry White Season, the movie, which was unbanned because it only a few people would watch it. And when they realized that only 200 people bought my album, they realized it wasn't such a huge, you know, there was a very small audience.
You're not competing with Bless.
Yeah, I'm not competing with Bless, nor am I competing with the Soul Brothers or you know. Yeah, so it was very interesting, the whole thing and the way the court had to work. So the funny thing is that the government did go through these things. They did believe in their laws and that you had to test their laws. And so that set a precedent. So other albums now could use Bigger Than Jesus as a precedent. I had to change the name to Beach Bomb because they said it was offensive sitting there in a record shop with that title. And John Lennon was my man.
But Beach Bomb is also a good title.
Mine stuck to the seat like chewing gum, children rock into the beat.
The original cover for Beach Bomb was going to be a rugby player diving over the try line holding a limpet mine.
So you were able still to get your records out. I mean, you pressed all your stuff, I think,
well,
in the UK,
that
didn't
one
you?
Was, they pressed them in England. Recommended Records pressed them, and I'd import 100 copies here, the vinyl separately from the covers. That we wouldn't be taxed so much. But that was kind of what was done, yeah. In fact, we got stuff pressed here through DJ. DJ, you remember that pressing plant called DJ?
They were in Bertram's.
In Bertram's, yeah.
In Lawrenceville. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they started pressing our stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were great.
Wasn't Shifty in Bertram's at some point?
Yes, the studio was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Indeed. That was in the 90s already.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the signings, because there's some really interesting ones. Let's talk about Corporal Punishment, because we've got a shared history with them, Shifty and Weir.
Six of the Best, right? They were on that.
We did Six of the Best with two songs, Victims, Victim, and Goddess of Depression. It was Wild Youth and the Safari Suits.
That's
on
right.
That compilation.
Yeah.
But Corporals, what is it about that band? I mean, that EP that you put out, Within the Night and Darkies and the other stuff. And I mean, that's a brilliant little EP. Also goes for a huge amount of money on the market. About Corporal Punishment that you saw?
Well, I think it was about the authenticity of their songwriting, the energy of their youth. Those two things. You weren't listening or looking at an artifice when you were involved with the Corporals. What you saw was what you were getting. They weren't trying to be something else. They were just trying to tell people about where they were in the world. And for me, that where they were in the world was saying something very interesting about this country. And James continued, James Phillips, the one of the songwriters. There was James, two songwriters in Corporal Punishment were Carl Grobenheimer and James Phillips. James Phillips kept on doing that throughout his entire songwriting career. And he developed as a songwriter in the most amazing way. Warwick ended up he went and did a music degree at Grahamstown and then at Wits. Warwick and him worked together on William Kentridge Productions and that kind of thing later on.
Yeah, and we did a few commercials, some film music, that sort of thing, yeah.
Because he's kind of like the thread that runs through Shifty, James, isn't he?
Well, he is. In a way, he brackets his my meeting him and getting interested in recording. And then one of the first recordings we did, I think, might have been the Corporals. Till his death in 1995. I mean, we recorded all of his music. Nobody else had recorded him.
Because if we could love one another, yeah.
And that was the most active time of Shifty in those years.
It would be helpful, wouldn't be hell.
Yeah.
gently. Oh, you can hold things against me. You can soothe my emotions. Oh, you can mix me poison potions. Oh, you can let it come between us.
Very big influence on me, and definitely the most talented songwriter that I worked with.
And the Benolas was the third Sir 50 album to come out, eh?
No, second one. Yeah, it was Live at Jammers and then Benolas, and then the White Album was supposed to come
out. And of course there's the Illegal Gathering as well.
Yeah, so they did that in Cape Town on their own bat, actually. We didn't. That was a little four-track cassette recording.
The Voice of Noit, yeah.
Brilliant.
It is brilliant. Talk about Phil Frey, much debated and dissected over the years, but he's part of that.
Yeah, so James is very influential in Phil Frey actually happening, because the album that Warwick mentioned now, Benolas Niemand, which was a bit of a kind of a joke album, eh? In a way.
Well, it was the whole fictional character that James made up. He invented this guy whose secret, James didn't want to take responsibility for him.
Yeah.
Wouldn't play at the launch.
No. We played, Warwick and I played at the launch with Ian Herman on drums. So instead of as usual, you know, the singer having the backing tracks, we played the music.
And the backing track was the singer, yeah.
Excuse me, are you recording?
Only pas, kop daaraan, ek se kind, skoon verdwaal. Gaan ek weer my cherry sien, as ek van die terrein af klim, ja, so waar, kopperaal, het is maar zwaar, kopperaal, ek speel oorlog met my beste daar, ja, 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 ek doen al my maaikies by my kaar, by my kaar. Genade aan my huis, hoort en haar, kopperaal, ek word na, kopperaal. My ou man se eerste kamp is klaar, ja, 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 kopperaal
André Latoy, a.k.a. Coors Gombas, picked that album up at, I think, the Shifty Stand at Green Market Square, probably in 1986 or 87. You know, he's basically a poet and an author, and at that stage, a bumala, basically, you know, old Coors. And it really inspired him. He thought, well, if this guy can do it, then there's a future for me writing songs in this country. And he sent us a demo tape, which was called Futsal Vergiftigung. Basically means food poisoning, which was one of the
great titles.
Ek is moek van alles, van my keel tot by my ballas.
What,
I think it was one of the lyrics.
Was that released?
Eh?
We haven't released any album called Food Poisoning, but
no, it's on Bandcamp. I released the demo.
Under that title.
That title. It's hilarious. I mean, it really is hilarious. And like you know, it's like usually if somebody sends you a demo, they try and impress you with the way they play or with the way they sing. He wasn't trying to do any of that. He was just being himself, which is, again, is what I was looking for in. And then, you know, it was the brilliance of his songwriting, really. You know, he would be the first to admit that he's a cuck guitar player and he can't really sing. But he managed to create the most beautiful melodies. And the atmosphere which he presented them was so disarming. It's one of the only demos that I just knew immediately I had to get this guy into the studio. And when I did, basically, I set him down on a chair. And I said, I switched the tape recorder on. I said, I just want you to do exactly what you did for the demo tape. Because he talked in between all the songs and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I just wanted it to sound good, much better than it was like recorded on a crappy tape. And then I went out shopping, you know, came back an hour and a half later. And there was basically the root of that album.
The Kalahari.
We recorded one or two tracks with a vocalist, Dineke Volschenk. I think she came in and sang. And that was the record. It was basically him solo. And that was called Ver van hierdie Kalahari. Op die grense verkeerde kant sit ons en ons eet calamari en lach oor die dalende rand. It was just beautiful. You know,
that had Colfoot also on.
No, it didn't. No, that was Niemand's Land. That was later. Ralph Raby.
Yeah, Cat Gold.
Who was working for Rapport, I think, was sent down to Cape Town to come and interview André Latoy. And they just got on like a house on fire. And then I think Ralph played André some of his stuff, and André realized this guy was like an amazing songwriter. So they started getting, that's where the whole Full Faith thing started. And then, of course, Ralph changed his name to Johannes Kerkhoddel, and André changed his name to Coors Gombas, and the Griffin Blues Band happened. And they were all, André was in the Griffin Blues Band for the first one or two performances, but then he realized he didn't want to be in a band, he wanted to be solo. And then they were joined by Jannie Hannepoort van Tonder on trombone and drums, Gary Herselman on bass, better known as Pete Pairs.
Yeah.
Willem Bolo on guitar.
At what point did they do Picnic Bay Dingaan then? Was that before all that?
Yeah, but we had nothing to do with that.
Because I was given a recording of that. It was quite interesting. But they were both, that's where they met. That must have been the overlap.
Yeah, that was a bit later, I think, Picnic Bay Dingaan.
So the plan to put all of that together, was that Shifty's doing to put that tour together?
Absolutely. So we realized that we had an album that maybe we could actually sell. the Swedes actually funded a PA system for us and a combi, I think. And we hit the road. And we caused a huge stir, which was fantastic. You know, we were banned off various campuses. I think we were banned in Potch, and we were banned in – so we couldn't play in Bloem. And Stellenbosch, we were banned off campus. Had to play in the Drie Gevels venue outside town. But it was a riot. I mean, the whole tour was amazing.
But, you know, I'd recorded this guy called Pieter van der Lucht, and he had a song called Full Frey. And that was the one song I recorded, and a band called Quiz that were on the original album.
That was a live recording. I mean, not live, but live in the studio.
In the studio. But the full phrase song was done on it was MIDI. Peter van der Lucht was a keyboard player and stuff, and put together that song. So that we then decided to use that name from his song.
Because it has many meanings.
Yeah. And so that was the catch. Also, people loved that title as well.
Yeah. You
know, that was the origins of the whole Full Fray thing that then snowballed into the compilation album, and then obviously the Lloyd.
After that was the tour, and then
the movie. Lloyd did a movie.
Die ander dag toe voel ek laat. Ek wou 'n klein bietjie ontspan. En 'n boon maak 'n plan. Ek sit my TV set toe aan. Jy sal nie glo wat ek sien op my TV screen. Dit was 'n nare gesig. Dit het my heeltemal ontwrig. Dit was 'n moersaklig. Dit was PW's gesig. En langsam staan om pikkel. Ek dog ek gaan verstuk. Sit it up, sit it up.
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 Waar is sy al sy straf? Ek stap om buis te kry een bier en skakel oor na TV4. O my God, wat het ons hier? Wat my TV-screen ontsier. Is daar nergens om te vlug van die man se mooi gesig. Met sy vinger in die lug gaan hy my lewe net ontstuk. In die program in die lug sien jy net PW's gesig. Ek vat jou nou weg.
Was Eat Kreef the biggest seller in the catalogue?
Yeah, Eat Kreef and Mizrahi. So that was an incredible story as well, because that was banned. That was banned from not only the radio, but also banned from distribution and possession.
And the guy was locked up.
And he was locked up.
Yeah.
And change is pain.
Yeah.
As he got to know.
I think with Mizrahi it was pain made change, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Came out of there very differently.
He did.
Whatever they did to him.
Let's talk about the Mizrahi project, Change is Pain. I mean, it was quite a radical record for the even now when you listen to it, it's still very, very powerful.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I heard him for the first time at a Jodak cultural evening where there were quite a few people. That I listened to the recording the other day because I'm busy doing a docu on the moment about Johnny Clegg. And he was playing at that same Jodak thing.
Oh, was he?
It was a lovely, lovely thing. And then there were some poets, and then there was Mizrahi. And this guy is incredibly powerful, big voice, very intense. And I just thought, well, it'd be amazing to actually put a soundtrack behind this guy. So I got hold of him. I might have spoken to him afterwards or got hold of his, I can't remember how we connected. It was probably then I got his number or whatever. And it might have been through COSOR or something like that as well.
I think COSOR were quite...
The Congress of South African Writers might have been like the home for that, because there was a home for Vusi Matlasela and for
Lesecha
as well. Yeah. And I got three musicians in. So there was Ian Herman on drums, who played on 50% of our recordings, because that's a fucking
great
amazing
drummer. I used him as well. Yeah. Great drummer.
And Simba Mori, a guitarist from Kenya, songwriter from Kenya, who's around still. And Jita Bloy. Jita Bloy was playing not yet playing with Steve Newman, I don't think, and Ian in Tananas.
Jita was at the band called Pongola.
That's right. So I got those three musicians in, and then Warwick every now and again would do a bit of percussion and a bit of trombone, and we workshopped the songs. Mizwaki had really no sense of what was happening. I mean, we did try and do a couple of live things, but that didn't really seem to work. So I actually pasted these poems on top of the... So we got the vibe going, you know, then we'd record the backing track, and I'd record Mizwaki separately and then paste him on top of the music. And that's how Change is Playing the Album happened. And that was banned outright.
A new man is born, full of strength and agility, to demonstrate conventional wisdom in defense of the fatherland. Through canons of criticism, his dragon force and enthusiasm shall perform a daring combat against fascism. Men shall initiate a campaign against genocidal crimes committed and perpetrated against beloved humanity. Today, housing is another means of exploitation. And before the spirit of Hitler destroys men, wake me up to join you in the march to a people's kingdom. Man is swallowed by limited pleasures of time. Man is forsaken like a memory lost. Say it aloud. Justice is absent and democracy is nil. Say it aloud to counter the state lie. Again, shout it aloud. The government is riding fast to the greatest fall, from one great defeat to another. Collective bodies of young and old shall come to pass. Institutionalized violence is silent holocaust by design. However, like a surprise, the day shall dawn, and the world shall mourn at the burial of fascism, for a threat to world peace shall be no more. The doors of hell are golden, possessed and displayed by Western powers. Self-interest is a beacon to the graveyard. Hidden worms shall come to exposure, and collaborators like giant spiders shall belong to the dustbin of history. All this shall take root before dawn.
We found a way to distribute it, which was through bicycle shops, which was a big place for selling records in those days, eh?
Yeah.
Those little Indian stores.
Yeah.
We made thousands of little cassettes with no label on them.
They're
so
called,
they had no labels.
They were called Pete.
No, we sent them out called, they were called them Pete for some reason. Why do we call them Pete?
Because they would have been banned. I think it was short for poet.
Poet, yes. Someone, short. Yeah, it was our code for poet.
I think someone couldn't spell.
Anyway, so yeah, we probably moved like 25,000-30,000 of those cassettes.
Incredible.
You know, and then the next most popular album would have been Itkriev.
I think we had 10 cassette decks on top of each other. That's how we started manufacturing them ourselves. Mm. We actually, that was the Pete days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then we got another little guy to do that.
Then we found someone who would do them.
But it wasn't through EMI or Gallo or anything.
Yeah,
like
it was
that.
Totally bypassed.
It was all bypassed, yeah.
Hmm. It was Changes Pain. And then we did two albums there.
Yeah, then he ended up in jail.
Yeah.
For 8 months, I think. Yeah, solitary,
hectic. Yeah.
And then when he came out, we did the Unbroken Spirit.
Jennifer Ferguson. That's an amazing album, that debut album.
Yeah, very good.
Beautiful songwriter. And really fantastic to have like a girl on our label because we had so few. But it wasn't for want of wanting to have them around.
Because along with Leslie Ray, I mean, they were the really two big female singer-songwriters of the time. Mm-hmm. Both different, but both very unique. I mean, Dowling was a unique singer as well.
Totally.
But that first Jennifer album is just, I still play it. It's Angel Fish is such a brilliant song.
He'd tell me tales of how his angel fishes in his bedroom boy aquarium. On summer nights like these, we're doing things quite shocking and delightful. And if I wanted to, I could watch them. I could come up to his bedroom. All will be quite safe, quite safe, he said.
She's a great writer. Jennifer lives in Sweden now, still writing, but she's doing a whole other thing. It's much more spiritual and certainly not pop music.
Yeah, well, she's in Sweden.
Mm.
Yeah, they're a very spiritual place. That's where the old people of mountains.
That's one particular point. I don't think that's true.
Another great band on Shifty is The Genuines, which is, again, Ian Herman, drummer for Hire. And also, was he part of Issia?
Yesterday, Warwick and I were at an ashes spreading ceremony for Mac McKenzie in Corpay Harbour. Shafiq Kimi, who he played bass for Issia, his wife was there. So it all comes together, you see, Benji, like this. So, The Genuines, Mac McKenzie, Hilton Schilder, the two main songwriters. What an incredible band. I mean, we were just, I don't know. You know, certainly the scene that we were in, the Jamison scene, we were just completely, we couldn't believe it.
Suddenly the bar got really high,
it really did. These guys could all play the instruments fantastically.
Yeah.
And the energy was just absolutely incredible. And their sound was so unique, did that rock album, which is called Guma, which actually wasn't Guma music, except for the one song, which is hectic. I mean, that song goes 1,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And then we did the other album that we did was a Guma album, which wasn't called Guma. That was called Mr. Mac and the Genuine. So that was Mac's father, Sammy, who very interestingly, he was one of those Guma banjo players, from the Cape Minstrels days. Fantastic banjo player, but he had to be in the zone. This is the interesting thing about recording that album. Old Mr. Mac, it's probably from 10 o'clock. You'd have to feed him about like 2 glasses of red wine, and then you could record him for, for about an hour or an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And that was it. Okay, that was his zone. And Mac knew his father sort of perfectly.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that's a fantastic album. I'm almost happiest with that album.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite on the Shifty catalogue.
And also, I didn't use a lot of reverb on that album.
It was really good. Yeah.
In those days, I used too much reverb in my recording. That album is dry and it's like just pumps.
Yeah, it just pumps. And it's the speed. I mean, the tempos are just incredible,
And the energy. Robert Johnson was playing alto. Tony Cedros was playing sax. Unfortunately, both of whom are no longer with us.
Yeah.
Just what an incredible time.
Cape Town's always produced amazing jazz. So now you've had the 40th anniversary, the big party, yeah, which I sadly missed. What's happening with Shifty now? I mean, you seem to be a little bemused by all of these prices for the vinyl that people are paying for Shifty stuff. I mean, it's incredible what's happening. I mean, things like the carols and
yeah, we should chat about vinyl because there was a German delegation that came through, I think, the beginning of this year. Record. I don't know if you met anybody there, Benji. It was a whole lot of record industry people. Very nice guy that does a lot of vinyl. That's his whole thing. He distributes vinyl for over 150 little labels. Mm-hmm. And he was very keen to do something with us. And we should probably get onto that, you know, maybe start doing some compilations. And
yeah, we're thinking about, should one do compilations or would one
do like a Sunken Mortar album?
Or start marching through the catalog, you know.
And I think the general trend seems to be the original albums. So get back to my question here. What's happening with Shifty? I mean, is it dormant? Are you working on things?
The period for Shifty was probably until, as I say, James died in the mid-90s. Before that, we'd recorded Urban Creep. And, I mean, in terms of songwriters, Chris Letcher specifically is a songwriter that I really, really rate. And he joined up with Matthew van der Vant. And afterwards, I think in the late 90s, I did two albums with them. Low Riding and Bignity, and just really, I mean, just the songwriting, I just had to do it, you know. So every now and again something will come up and I did another record with Vusi Mahlasela, but that was through Sony BMG or whatever it's called these days, Sony, as a producer. Yeah. But in terms of Shifty new stuff, not a hell of a lot, you know. There were those two albums with Fundament Letcher, but then Rian Malan recently, I've done a record with him. I did his one in the mid-2000s, that's right, called Alien in Burlung, which was distributed through Sony BMG at that stage. And just recently, he's got a new band called Vastar. I recorded them probably about 2 or 3 years ago. And we haven't really properly put that out yet.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
We're not really good at, like, you know, the marketing and PR and all that kind of thing.
But quite a while back,
it's all changed now.
Yeah, I know.
What are you doing with Surfers?
I didn't understand it then. I understand it even less now. So there we go.
Well, Benji, quite a while back, I started uploading the Shifty catalog onto Bandcamp.
Mm. Right.
So pretty much every single thing is there, I mean, that we could find. We even at one point were thinking of wading into some of the quite interesting demo tapes. But so that, you know, I just thought it's really important to have everything in one place so you can get a – and it's nice just for – if you're presenting to someone, you can say, here's the link.
Hmm.
And you know, it took a long time to do. So when you download, for instance, the Sanken Mortar album, you get a lot of the photographs that Lloyd took of the band. In that – the great thing about Bandcamp is you can do a whole album download, and inside the download, you can put all sorts of little things, like the original Happy Ships drawings and – whatever you want, you know. So I've done all my Surfers albums on Bandcamp similarly. And I've had recently a guy in England who's fascinated with the kind of late 70s Porter Studio recordings and early kind of the sound of the late 70s, early 80s. He's just released a vinyl album. He made a compilation of a lot of my old stuff that was some of it, one or two songs from Own Affairs, but a lot of outtakes from the first cassette I put out and a lot of stuff that was never released. It was off Porter Studio recordings that I put on Bandcamp. So, yeah, it's...
So you did a vinyl of that and you agreed, you just said download the stuff from...
Yeah, I told him to download, yeah. I mastered it and cut them together because often they were long jams and you just wanted that bit, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, the rest was crap.
Hmm.
So you can often find, yeah, really good bits in a one-hour jam. You can at least find a 3 minutes,
yeah,
kind of little bit.
Kalahari Surfer albums were recorded and released in a time that was very different to now. There was an obvious target out there, which was apartheid. That's now come and gone, but some of its stepchildren are still around. Corruption, ongoing racism, political violence, GBV. Surely there must be another Kalahari Surfers album there challenging that.
Yeah, I put out albums all the time. I've got one. I've done a. Remember the State Capture Death Squad? Remember that whole thing that happened in the news? They arrested some poor guy who was. innocently sitting in his shack somewhere as being a member of some, they call it the State Capture Death Squad or something. It was like this bizarre story. So I made a whole track. So I've done quite a lot of things on Bandcamp. If you have a look there, I did two.
I'll go and have a look, yeah.
Yeah, I did a Lesecha album during COVID. He was destitute. He was in some god-awful place, people dying around him, and they'd looted all the shops. There were Ethiopians or something that for some reason they got looted. So to get supplies.
Because they were foreigners.
For their foreigners, yeah. So anyway, Lesecha was stuck, so I told him to read his new poems in a car, so you know, on his phone. And I did a whole album with those poems and raised a couple of grand for him over the COVID period.
I don't think I've even heard that. I didn't even know you did that, Warwick.
And one of the tracks is way out there. It's like a Captain Beefheart backing. I don't know where I got
it. Oh, Captain Beefheart.
It's like, well, it's a pure Beefheart track with Lesecha's poetry over the top. So anyway, that was a recent-ish album. And then I've done all sorts of bits and pieces. But I haven't done it. I've just done a PhD that's taken, you know, 5 years to kind of get through. So I haven't really had album in me right now.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, other than that, Benji, just to answer your question, what do we do? Yeah, every now and again, you know, we did the Shifty 30 in 2014, big concert in Joburg, where we flew people in from, you know, with Jennifer from Sweden, Ian from, et cetera, from San Francisco, et cetera, et cetera. And then we just did, last year we did the Shifty 40, which was lovely. Very small crowd, probably 150 people. It was really nice and intimate on top of a kopje and on the West Coast. And then, you know, my documentary career has actually, funnily enough, quite a few movies about music, okay? So during COVID, I did a Shifty film festival, basically. And all my movies are up there, a lot of them about music. So there's one about James Phillips called Famous for Not Being Famous. There's one about the Full
Freight
Tour.
I've seen that, yeah.
The Full Freight Tour. There's one about Urban Creep. There's one. There's quite a few movies about music. But also, you know, it's my output. That's what I've been doing since the mid-90s is making documentaries.
And you're doing a Clegg one now, are you?
One of the Cape Malay choir scene, which Mac from the Genuines is in. He narrates the film. That's the, you know, it's probably one of my best films.
I think it's Lloyd's best. Yeah, it's called The Silver Fez.
The Silver Fez.
Yeah,
but you know, on the shifty.co.za, one can find all these things, and also, you know, join our Facebook page. Whoever's out there that's interested in the stuff is being posted. Yeah, that's basically
on Bandcamp, Shifty, and
on Bandcamp,
Bandcamp, so there's a lot of stuff.
Just Google Bandcamp Shifty Records and you'll get to us.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.
Even Dr. Goebbels made mistakes. one. Drop three bits, but still having fun. With the Son of God, he's got the shades. He knows he made some bad mistakes. It's a big rock beat on civil rights. Fun with the forces every night. I advertise, I hypnotize, reorganize, I sympathize. I'm music, I'm music, I'm a vehicle of the state. Big business, that prove me, their policies dictate. I'm music, pop music, I'm a vehicle of the state. Big business, that prove me, their policies dictate. What harmony and melody and words that make no sense to me. For the
hey, here's the worry when the pros ask for my bread. Hey, now I spend it, get it out of my head. Hey, now I jump, I've got no time to worry, cause I'm dancing, oh yeah. Oh yes, I'm dancing, oh yeah. I gotta keep dancing, oh yeah. Where's the joke? Hey,
where's the joke?
Where's the joke?
Hey.
Wish to know.
What did you bring him from?